The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
I call the meeting to order. Let's get on with our session this morning. In the absence of our regular chair as vice chair, I will try to keep order in this meeting. Welcome to all of you. We have the Auditor General with us today, and perhaps we could start with the formalities of people introducing themselves. Let's start at the other end today. Mr. Earle, do you want to start just by saying your name into the mic?
Eddie Earle, MLA, Cape Breton North, filling for Alan McMaster, MLA for Inverness.
Thank you.
Hi, Chris D'Entremont, MLA for Argyle, sitting in for Chuck Porter.
Okay.
Morning, Wayne Gaudette, MLA for Clare, replacing Keith Collum.
Clary McKinnon, MLA, Pictou East. Good morning, welcome.
Brian Scobar, MLA for Cumberland North.
Matt Wynot, MLA, Hammonds Plains, Upper Sackville.
Becky Kent, MLA, Cole Harbour, Eastern Passage, filling in for Gary Ramey.
Okay, thank you. Darlene?
Darlene Henry, committee clerk.
Al Horgan, Deputy Auditor General.
Jacques Lapointe, Auditor General.
Terry Spicer, Assistant Auditor General.
Evangeline Coleman said, Assistant Auditor General.
Thank you, and welcome to the Auditor General and his staff today. We're going to proceed with our questioning based on the latest report. I wondered, we do have, of course, the report, and we've all had the opportunity to read it. Did you wish to add to it by making an opening statement?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could just make a quick opening remarks. And you, I thank you for the opportunity to be here. As you know, my fall report was tabled in the House of Assembly on November 21. Now, this was my third report in 2012. It covered audit work completed by the office in the summer and fall of this year. And I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to discuss it with you today. And with me today are Deputy Auditor General Alan Horgan and Assistant Auditors General Terry Spicer and Evangeline Coleman-Sad. Now, Alan, Terry, and Evangeline were each responsible for certain chapters in the report, so I'm sure that among us we can answer any questions that you may have. Before I begin, I do want to acknowledge the valuable work, the dedication, and the professionalism of all my staff. Their efforts made it possible for us to provide assurance to the House of Assembly on the operations of government. And I also thank the many public servants in departments and agencies whose cooperation was vital to the success of our audits. There are four chapters in the report in addition to the introduction. We make 107 recommendations, all intended to improve departmental and agency operational efficiency and effectiveness. I will just, knowing that you have the report, just briefly mention the topics that are covered. In Chapter 2, we report on our audit of the homeschooling program at the Department of Health. We found a need for a significant improvement to this program. As it stands now, the Department of Education is not properly fulfilling its responsibility to protect the rights of homeschooled children. Chapter 3 deals rather extensively with systems at Capitol Health and the IWK Health Center that manage the personal health information of patients. We found numerous and significant weaknesses in processes that protect the privacy of this information and that keep important healthcare information systems operating on a 24/7 basis. In Chapter 4, we report that capital budgeting and spending in the hospital system needs improvement, And we note that existing spending levels and spending allocations are not adequate to prevent the ongoing deterioration of hospital infrastructure and equipment in the province. And our last chapter discusses our audit of the Trade Center Limited, where we found that financial and operational activities are not appropriately managed. The Trade Center requires a major overhaul of its financial management practices to achieve an appropriately professional level of management. With that, Mr. Chair, it will be our pleasure to answer any questions that the committee may have on our report.
Thank you very much. Our usual procedure is to turn to each caucus for 20-minute tranches of questions. I did receive a message that Mr. Younger is delayed in traffic, but will be here soon. Mr. Gaudette, did you wish to start for your caucus?
No.
No? Okay. Do you want to pass for now? Okay. And Mr. Earl, I guess it's over to you, is it?
Just with the homeschooling, I realize that the Department of Education has been, lacking the tools to make sure that children who are being homeschooled are properly followed. I guess the biggest question is, have the processes been or are being developed to ensure that the children that are moving between public, private, and homeschool are being tracked properly?
I would say that there are very little processes in place in any part of that program, and including the tracking of students moving from one aspect of the school system to another, so that the department really doesn't track very well when students move from the homeschooling system to the public or vice versa. So they need to, we did comment to the fact that they need to improve that tracking system.
Now, if a parent decided they wanted to homeschool their child, how do they go about registering so that they receive the proper information to do this schooling at home?
Well, there is a registration form that parents are required to complete when they do this. They submit it to the department. It does identify that the student is moving to a homeschooling system. But there's very little follow-up or information on that system.
Are all the children that are being homeschooled registered with the Department of Education, do you know?
We can't be certain that, because the tracking is poor, that all students' whereabouts are known.
So if someone does leave the public school to go into the homeschool program, well, they should be easily tracked?
Well, they should.
If they didn't register, say, the following year, would the school system go to see where that child was, if they moved or if they were gaining homeschooling? Or would that, if, say, you went from one school to another, if I was living in Cape Breton and moved to Halifax and registered in Halifax, would it show that I registered in Halifax compared to Cape Breton, or would that have to be, and would vice versa, same thing happen for a homeschool system?
I think what I'll do is ask Mr. Spicer to provide you more details on exactly how that works.
Yep.
Thank you. If a child is moving from a public school system in one board to another board, the system that it's a new system actually that they have in place now would track that fairly well. The problem becomes when a child leaves the public school system and decides that they want to be homeschooled. Right now, the school boards don't have a requirement to let the homeschooling people at the department know that that's actually happening. So our understanding from talking to the school boards is that if the child was really young, they would probably do some work to find out where that child is. If they're not in their school board anymore, does anybody know if they moved or whatever? But but that's difficult to do with the numbers of children. So the problem tends to be when the child leaves the public school system to be homeschooled, the homeschooling system is not informed of that to do the proper follow-up to make sure, in fact, they are registered in homeschooling, or if they didn't, where did they go?
So as they get older, you say that's the biggest problem. Are there standards being put in place, or have there been recommendations made to try and improve that system?
Yeah, we've made some recommendations in our report that indicate that, I mean, they have a fairly comprehensive system in place now at the public school systems. What they really need to be doing is having the school boards or somebody informing, if you're leaving the system, or if you're leaving public school system, to let the homeschooling people know that this child plans to be homeschooled, so that they're aware and they can follow up the next year to make sure that they are in fact registered in homeschooling. And if they're not registered in homeschooling, did they register in another part of the province in the public school system, or did they attend private school, or so they can do some manner of follow-up on that.
So when a child does the proper registration, they get registered for homeschool, do they receive a package with the goals for that school year for the grade level they're to be schooled at?
In the homeschooling program, no, they don't. They receive a registration form. That registration form, the parents are then supposed to provide sort of a home, their program plan, or what they plan to teach the child. But there's very little as far as instructions that are being sent to the homeschooling people to identify, you know, what are the expected outcomes. And in fact, that's another one of the recommendations in the report, that the department really does need to establish what are the expected learning outcomes for the homeschooling students at the various grade levels, so that parents know, if they choose to go to the homeschooling route, these are the general expectations of what your children should be learning and the skills that they should be getting.
So are they provided with the tools, the literature, the books, the whatever, to see that they achieve those goals?
No, not now. They're not. No, they can, the department, they can ask for some help, and the department will provide what they can. But right now, there's very limited information that's provided to the homeschooling parents to provide guidance in that area.
And are the families or the parents interviewed or provided assignments or testing to know that they are achieving the goals they need in the homeschool system?
The department does not, at present, does not test the kids in the homeschooling program to see whether they're making appropriate educational progress.
So if a parent is not diligent in what they're doing at home, the child could really fall behind fairly quickly and not achieve the goals it needs to, I guess, move to the next grade level and eventually graduate from the public school system.
That's definitely the one of the highest risks that we identified with the program, is that the Department of Education right now doesn't have the information it needs to be able to assess whether children are making appropriate educational progress.
So in your mind, or in your evaluation, would you say that the bulk of the children who are being homeschooled, how many are being homeschooled, do we know?
This year was around 850. It fluctuates from year to year, but it's 850 to 1,000, depending on the year.
So, and I'm assuming, and I hope I'm correct in assuming this, that the children are being homeschooled at home are receiving what they need, but there is no indication to say that as of now.
That's right. That's correct, yeah.
So there are steps being put in place by, you guys have made recommendations. Is there any idea that those recommendations were going to be followed through to see that that happens?
Well, Jack, do you want to?
Yes, I can address that. We have had a meeting with, of course, with the Department of Education to discuss these recommendations, and the indication we were given was that they do treat this very seriously. It is they do recognize that what's being done right now is minimal, and that the recommendations do need to be implemented. So I'm hopeful that, given that they indicate they are taking it seriously, that they will, in fact, implement what we recommend.
And have they given you guys any timelines of when those recommendations may take place or begin to take place?
They have indicated it's a two-step program they'll be following. They will. There are some of these recommendations they say can be done very quickly, and they identify which ones, you know, they feel can be done fast. Some tracking issues and so on. Some will require more study and policy, and even they say some changes of legislation to give them more power. I don't know how much legislation is required to be changed to do these things, but they indicate that some of the recommendations will take longer to do.
But they didn't give you a timeline of when that would take place or begin to take place. I know the ones that are easy will probably take place right away, but the more difficult ones, they say the tracking or this, the testing, have they given you a timeline of how long that may take?
I think at this point it's a little uncertain.
Because the longer that takes, the more chance that there are of children falling through the cracks, I guess, is so to speak. And is there any indication, or is there, are you guys confident that that's not happening now, or is there any indication that the education the children are getting at home is as good or better than the school system itself?
We don't have any knowledge of how well these children are doing, and neither does the department. And that, of course, is our primary concern with this. That if you were to ask us or the department whether the children in the school homeschool system are being properly schooled, we could not answer that question because we don't know, and neither does the department.
So if a child was going to go from being homeschooled back into the public education system, where would we know what grade level or what classroom to put them in? Are they tested then, or is it just that they, because of their age and their supposed grade level, they go back to that?
Yes, they are tested. I'll ask Mr. Spicer to address that.
Thank you.
Yeah, when they return to the public school system, they are tested to see sort of where they fall. Typically, I believe that they would be placed in a classroom at their age group, but then what would happen would be any sort of extra resources that they would need to address any areas where they were weak would be provided through the public school system at that time. So yes, they are tested. They're typically placed with their peers, but then they would be provided with the resources that they would need to correct any problems that they may have, if they have any.
So I guess just a couple more quick questions on the homeschooling part of it. With the funding aspect of it, we're hearing that every student in the public school system gets in and around $10,000 a year towards their education. And we've discussed this before with the special needs children. And do these children who are home have that, I guess, the amount of money available to them for resources that they may need to do the homeschooled part of it?
No, our understanding is that there's no funding provided to the parents for homeschooling.
Even now, if it was a special needs child who needed maybe special seating, or maybe the attention span wouldn't be great enough to sit in a public school system, but they could use that stuff at home, that stuff wouldn't be provided to the parent?
Well, there is some resources available through the department for special cases, and I believe they also, a homeschooling child can partake in public school classes if it's available to them. So if the school board is able to accommodate that, but there is no specific funding that's provided to each homeschooled parent or child as part of the program, but as certain needs arise, I believe the department does attempt to help the parents with those special needs.
And was there any indication that that's been done over the last year or two to help a child in homeschool with financially, I guess, the best?
In the files that we tested, there was no children that we saw that requested that. Now, through conversations with management at the department, they have indicated that that's been done in the past. So I don't have a specific example, but again, based on our interviews with management, that they indicated that that is has been done in the past.
But that's just interviews. There's no solid evidence to say that happened. So it really didn't happen, in other words, because I asked that question here one other time about endoscopes and stuff like that being done, and if it's not documented, we're told it doesn't happen. So... correct.
Well, based on we didn't look at all the files in the homeschooling program. We looked at 120 files. So of the 120 files that we looked at, but it may have been that those children were not ones that had special needs as well. So
I guess we'll move on to the IT section now for a few minutes. What do we have, about 6 minutes left? I guess my biggest question is past employees. I'm a past healthcare employee myself, and I had access to the system at home in Cape Breton for medical information. Do past employees still have that access to the information here in the Capital Health and the IWK system? Or is their access terminated when they're terminated or when they take leave away from the hospital?
I'll ask Mr. Hogan to say a little more to that, but I can tell you that the theory is that that employees are taken off the access to information once they're terminated or once they leave the system. But one of our findings was that this does not always occur. So that people can be out, be gone from the system, but still have access.
Certainly. We tested for that, and we found some cases where staff had left the hospital and still had their user IDs and access to various accounts. As a practice, both hospitals are very aware that they need to, terminate computer accounts for people to leave the hospital. But sometimes the people who terminate the accounts, who are basically people in IT support, aren't aware of everyone that that might leave. So in cases like that, there needs to be a strong connection between the personnel department of an organization and the IT department. And, as we were talking to them about these findings, the hospitals agreed wholeheartedly that they had to kind of strengthen that connection, the passing of information between those two operations.
So I know myself, I had access to, in the Cape Breton District Health Authority, 4 or 5 different hospitals because of my position. And when I left, I had no indication that my information or my ID would be terminated. Would that, or has that, I guess the big question is, has that been breached or has that posed a risk so far, or in the studies that you've done, has there been any findings that someone who has left may have tried to access that information?
We did not come across anything like that. I mean, definitely risk. I mean, any area that we can control presents the risk, but we did not see, and we weren't told of any instances where, a prior employee kind of abused that, the systems because they still had access.
I would sure hope that it doesn't happen, just as a professional, being a professional. But if that did happen, would there be a red flag raised on that, or would it come up that my access was... or that I would try to access the system after being off it for so long, or is there anything in place to see that or show that?
A number of their systems have logs that will log who is accessing a system and changing data on a system and the like. We looked at various systems at both of the health centers and found that while a number of systems have logs, a number of systems don't have the logs for various reasons, some because the systems are very old. But just because something's logged, it doesn't mean that these logs will be examined, and such access, inappropriate access, will necessarily be found. We mentioned in our report that that there needs to be some kind of a proactive monitoring of computer logs, just to look for cases just as you described, or other cases where maybe even employees of the organization are viewing things, accessing things that they should not be. And both organizations agree that there needs to be systems to do that.
And how often would those logs be checked? You say everything is logged, and
yes.
And I know when we start, we sign an agreement of confidentiality to not deal in areas that we're not supposed to be dealing in. But how often would that be checked, or was there any indication that it was checked on a regular basis or even checked at all?
We found generally that the logs are not being checked. Logs kind of serve two purposes. One, preventative, so that, if someone does something inappropriate, the log will point it out right away. But also logs can be used to investigate instances. So if something comes to, a manager's attention that something might be wrong, they can go back to the logs already aware that maybe something has happened, and then they can investigate and see the details. As to reviewing logs, these logs are very, very large. Because they're logging, everything that every user does on these various systems. So in order to monitor logs, you really need software to do it. You need software to basically, go through all the data and pick out anomalies and Neither of these organizations have that kind of software at the moment.
So there's really nothing to stop me from going in and, say, checking my wife's blood work or my next-door neighbor's x-ray, if so. So I would have access to it, but now me checking blood work as a physiotherapist probably wouldn't be appropriate as such, but there wouldn't be a red flag raised up to say that I was checking whatever that wouldn't pertain to my my department, I guess, is the best question, would there?
Yeah, like if the access you still had enabled you to do those things, I would think that it probably wouldn't be noticed, particularly quickly. Until then, perhaps they, get the software and get it up and running. And even still, that will only pick out certain cases.
And I will say I will not do that. That's one thing I won't go back and check on. I just want to make sure that by what we're implementing here today, or what you recommend, that the security of Nova Scotian citizens and their healthcare files are going to remain secure. And there are processes put in place to make sure that that's going to continue to happen. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The first tranche is expired. Mr. Younger, in your absence, Mr. Gaudet chose to pass on the first opportunity to ask questions, but I'll go back to you now. If you'd like 20 minutes on behalf of the Liberal Caucus, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for being late, but I thank the member for from Clare for waiting for me. I know there's a lot of chapters to cover, and we'll do them all in depth at a later time, but there's a few points in each one of them I thought I might try to cover. And the first one, I might as well follow up with some on the homeschooling side. And I think we probably all recognize, as many children as there are being homeschooled, there are probably as many reasons for that homeschooling. Sometimes it might be distance from schools that parents don't feel comfortable with them traveling in some parts of the province, or sometimes it's special needs or exceptional needs, or I mean, there's all kinds of options. I wonder whether the two areas I just wanted to ask about was one, you had touched on this when the member for Cape Breton North asked around supports given through the public system, and I am aware of a number of people, especially within more urban areas, who are able to access physical education programs, art programs, science programs in the public school to complement the homeschooling program. And I've spoken to a number of parents who do access those resources. And I'm wondering whether maybe you didn't look at this, but I'm wondering whether that was tracked at all.
I'll ask Mr. Spicer to answer your question.
Oh, sure, thank you.
We haven't seen where that's been tracked, and there was no information that we looked at within the files that we looked at that would suggest that was being tracked in any way. And I'll go back to my earlier comments from management, and as you've stated, that we understand that that is available, and that's done through maybe the homeschooling association or the individual parent with the school board.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it's arranged. As I say, I do know it happens because I've spoken to a number of parents who, whatever it is, on Monday morning they go to physical education class, or in the upper school level they'll go to the science labs, because of course it's pretty hard to run a Bunsen burner and everything in your kitchen. And that makes sense. I mean, that there's actually some logic to that in my sense. But what concerns me is that obviously schools, public schools, are funded on the basis of being able to provide supports to students. And if it's not tracked, is there a concern? And I'm not saying it shouldn't be provided to homeschooling parents, but what I'm concerned is that if a particular school has to deliver those services to a homeschooled child and it's not tracked, then it's very hard to track the cost of that so that the schools are appropriately funded for those students. Is that a real risk, or is that wouldn't be a concern?
Well, I guess it's a risk, and it's tough to answer that because we really have no idea how much of that goes on. I mean, I think, again, we do know that that is available to homeschooling parents through the school boards, but the extent of which that happens
is impossible.
We really don't know, and I don't believe the Department of Education would know as well. Whether the school boards track that themselves, they may do that. we didn't look at that as part of the audit.
Okay, and I assume, maybe incorrectly, but I assume the boards would know which students are showing up, and so I would hope they do. And my concern is if the board's not doing it, that it's hard for the board to determine appropriate funding and whether they need to, resources. Similarly, I'm wondering, now, not some homeschool children will just do it for elementary or just a couple of years, and some go all the way through. And I've spoken to, I don't want to overstate the number, but just a couple of people who had trouble once they reached the transition to community college or university, or in most cases university. And I've actually heard this with some of the private schools as well, so it's not unique to homeschooling, is acceptance of the high school completion certificate. Is there, and I know that your audit noted that it's hard to assess meeting the objectives, and everybody can have a different curriculum as you go along, but once you hit grade 12, or what we assume is completion of grade 12, there are certain requirements to meet a Nova Scotia High School graduation certificate, and some of those include five equivalent credits of grade 12 level. So if you're in the public school, that's very easy. You've taken five grade 12 classes, you've passed them with whatever mark is the pass. Do they have a matrix set up to, has the department set up any kind of matrix that would measure equivalencies for the high school completion certificate in homes for homeschooled children?
No, they haven't.
Should they?
Well, I mean, I guess that would be a question for the department. But I mean, our audit focused on assessing the children as they go along. Now we understand that the universities, as an example, if you wanted to attend university and you were being homeschooled, that they would. They would require perhaps some testing that to be done to evaluate whether they had the skill set that they needed to be successful there. I think that's really a question for the department and where they want to go with the homeschooling program.
No, that's a fair comment. And I think you're right. I think some of the universities do testing, and I've heard, and again, I want to be completely fair to parents in the homeschooling association, that there are, I don't even know what the percentages would be, but I know a lot of them do very well, and some of them actually excel better than kids coming out of the public system. So there's a range, and I've also talked to a couple parents who their son or daughter then had to go back and had to do a GED program because there were certain things that were that the university or the place they were applying to felt were missed. And so I think that obviously we can talk to the department about that when that comes forward. I'm going to jump a bit to the Trade Center audit, and I can't remember which person exactly did. Oh, that's you. It's your lucky day. I was reading the responses from Trade Center Limited, and I guess I want to get some clarity on them, and perhaps you don't have any clarity to provide beyond what's here, and if you don't, that's fair. In a number of cases, they made comments like I'll flip up to where it was. Things like that they felt that their processes were already adequate. In fact, they said the same thing over and over and over again, which I thought was kind of amusing. For example, on page 93 of the report, if anybody's following along at home, the Trade Center response, and the wording is almost the same for a few of them. TCL believes that the financial and operational controls and processes that TCL has in place, including compensatory controls, have been adequate to provide reasonable assurance that reliable financial information is produced and the operations are managed effectively. However, TCL will undertake an assessment of its internal control systems. You obviously feel differently, or it seems you feel differently, that the controls were not adequate, and I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on that.
I can, sure. I can just start and let Mr. Spicer add a little more detail, but in general, I would say that the response of the management at the Trade Center is a denial that there is anything wrong. If you look through their responses, you will see repeated assertions that no, their financial management practices are adequate, their internal controls are adequate. They deny, in fact, most of our findings and recommendations, while sometimes saying that, well, nevertheless, they will go ahead and, you know, do a review. But they are not accepting that there are any issues with financial management. They are saying, in effect, that their financial management practices are acceptable, and we are saying that they are poor. And when we are, in fact, saying that they need a major overhaul of their entire financial administration, and if you, and they, in effect, don't agree with really any of the significant recommendations. Well, they agree with a couple of minor ones to do with expense claims and so on. But even there, they seem to say that, for instance, the CEO's expense claims were treated, you know, consistently, or some such wording. Well, we're saying they were not reviewed, they were not approved, and they were not appropriate in terms of what was submitted. Yeah. Did you want to?
I think summed it up pretty good. I think paragraph. I mean, if you look through we many of the details in the report on paragraph 5.23, we've identified 14 different control weaknesses. Paragraph 5.24, we've identified 9 instances where the controls weren't working as required. As Mr. Lapointe said, we've identified issues with how travel claims are being processed and the documentation supporting those. There was issues in the procurement area. There was issues with the support for allocation of costs between specifically the Metro Center and the Trade Center Limited. So I think the report, I believe, stands for itself. There's a number of issues that have been identified here that would be inconsistent with management's response.
You have, over the years, your office has audited a number of these organizations, which are, I guess, semi-autonomous, but they're still under the purview of a department. And one of the things that you pointed out consistently was not following the standard provincial procedure. So it's funny that their response is that they manage things consistently, and that seems to be true, but not consistently within the rules, consistently sort of what appears to be skirting the rules. In the case of, for example, a CEO, it's fine. If you're a lower-level staff person, then the CEO probably signs off on your expense claims. In other organizations like this within the government structure, who would normally sign off on the CEO's expenses and that sort of thing?
In this case, it's pretty straightforward. The board of directors, more specifically the chairman of the board of directors, would be the appropriate person to sign off on CEO's expense claims. And that's what I expect to see happening starting now.
Okay. This is obviously, it's a serious issue regardless of whether anything was happening, but now that we're moving towards a new trade center, this strikes me as a much more important issue because one assumes there'll be a much larger budget and so forth going forward. What is the relationship, or what did you find to be the relationship, if any, between oversight in the department and these sorts of things in Trade Center? Because, for example, in some of the other, I'm going to call them semi-autonomous, I'm sure there's a better word, but these semi-autonomous organizations, the department often has some sort of oversight. So if it's Film Nova Scotia, the, you know, tourism goes in and they check things now and again. I don't know how often, but now and again. Was there any sort of oversight of that nature from the Department of, Economic and Rural Development and Tourism, I think is what it's called now, and Trade Center Limited?
From what we saw, the Trade Center is operating as an independent agency. And quite often that's the case. In fact, the intention, when an agency is set up with a board of directors, the board of directors does report to the minister, but assumes really a fiscal responsibility. And managerial responsibility. They are the ones who have oversight over the organization, so that the department isn't involved in any way.
Okay. I noticed that on page, and the reason I asked that is because I noticed on page 88 of your report, you looked at the funds that were transferred from government in table 5.9 to Trade Center Limited. Mm-hmm. Now, it says total funding from government. I assume that's, it is, yeah, that's combined provincial, federal, and HRM funding. In most years, most of the funding was HRM, which I believe is related to the management agreement for the Metro Center. And that's a pretty consistent number, over in the ballpark of $570,000. In 2010-11, there was a one-time operating grant of $4.8 million. And I know that they were given a one-time, I had thought they were given a one-time operating grant because of some deficit issues. But this seems to have been far in excess of the deficit, which would have otherwise been $1.2 million, which was down from the previous year, and it results in actually giving them a net profitability of $4.7 million. Was there any indication of why that grant was issued, or was that an advance payment on something? Or
Rather than thinking of it as advance payment, think of it as a catch-up, and that the Trade Center operates at a loss every single year, and is subsidized for that loss by the provincial government. There's a fairly steady small amount from Halifax and a certain amount of a small amount of funding from the federal government, but the province subsidizes a loss, and this was catching up on accumulated losses of prior years. My understanding is that they have been informed that they are, by a certain point, to be operating a balanced budget, but that is not the case yet.
Okay. I appreciate that clarification. Was there any indication that, given that the province, obviously the province is subsidizing, and I think they, I'm not sure, but it appears that many of these organizations around North America, at least, are similarly subsidized by some level of government or by some mechanism. Is, given that sort of annual subsidy and the desire to work towards a balanced budget, have you noticed any plans, either as a result of your audit or beforehand, of the department planning to do additional oversight to ensure that they reach that point? I didn't see anything in the responses that would indicate there's plans for...
I would say we haven't in our audit come across any intention to have any kind of increased oversight, you know, in relation to the funding. So we don't have anything in our files on that.
Okay. One of the other issues you talked about was their the report they did examining the new World Trade and Convention Center. And you recommended that a second opinion be done. And if I read your comments correctly, you're neither saying that, you're basically saying that their assertions aren't supported and that they're neither right or wrong. You just can't tell because they seem to be, I would use the word guesses, or educated guesses in some cases. Is that a fair characterization?
I would say what we were looking at, you know, was a very specific, some specific financial information given by the Trade Center as part of the decision-making. Now, these are the economic impact analyses where they project how much business will be generated in the future and therefore how much money will be generated in the area by the additional business. And we know that that was one of the many factors in the decision to create a convention center. But that particular information was a financial exercise. Well, we looked at it. That information had significant flaws in the backup research and analysis to create the numbers, and that is why we thought that a concern was that the government needs to have good, solid information provided to them when they are making decisions, and there's a responsibility by management and staff to provide government and cabinet appropriate information. And we've had similar recommendations with other audits that we've done in which we said that what's going forward is simply not of a quality that is appropriate for going up the line. And so on that basis, we said that the it would be a good idea for additional work to be done by someone else to provide accurate forecasts of economic impact. And that's a recommendation we made.
Okay. I'm not sure whether you can respond to this or not. I've often been concerned about for economic impact studies because I think that they are often educated guesses at the best when we say there's this going to be a spin-off of X number of jobs or X number of millions of dollars. And then when you get multiple projects, it's, you know, you're counting them two and three times between different projects. And is that... And I don't. I agree with you that there should be another study done. I don't. But I'm wondering whether this is a problem, even if it's worse in this case, with the nature of that kind of study, where we are asking. And I don't know why we've started asking people to do this. We've started to ask people to do projections of there'll be this many spin-off jobs and this much economic activity, when really that's almost impossible to measure until after the fact. I saw a study recently that talked about, you know, a certain project would have this many new hairdressers and this many new, you know, fast food joints. And that strikes me as being, you know, maybe a very educated guess, but a guess nonetheless.
I'll ask Mr. Spicer to talk a little bit more about
Thank you.
What we think is happening here.
You're correct. I mean, projections are future oriented, so by their nature they're likely going to be wrong. I guess the question is, you know, one would expect that appropriate amount of rigor is put behind the assumptions that are done, and that's the issue that we saw here was that as the report lays out, there was a number of areas that we believe weren't appropriately considered when coming up with the assumptions. So, yes, it is a best guess at by nature, but there is an assumption and a level of rigor that should be behind, especially a significant project like this that we believe just simply wasn't done here.
Okay, thank you. The 20-minute tranche for the Liberal caucus has expired. We move now to the NDP caucus. Mr. McKinnon.
Thank you very much. Good morning. As a long-serving school board member, I want to zero in on the homeschooling at first. In Section 214 of your report, it states that the Education Act and regulations do not specify what homeschool children should know and be able to come up with the outcomes. Does that mean that the department would have to make changes in the Education Act to implement your recommendations?
I'll ask Mr. Spicer to address that, please.
It is true that the Education Act doesn't specify what homeschooled children would need to know. So it would follow, I would assume, that the Education Act would need to be updated if, in fact, they were going to go that route, yes.
Do you have any suggestions on what kind of changes would have to be made?
Well, it's really, as the report lays out, it's really up to the Department of Education to determine, well, what are the expected outcomes that you would like homeschool children to achieve? And they have a number of options. The public school system has a fairly robust set of outcomes and guidelines that are expected. They could either use those. They could, if they feel that they should be different for homeschooled children, then they need to develop and articulate what those are. They could use a combination of the two, but it's really up to the Department of Education to figure out, well, what do we expect homeschooled children and what skills do we expect them to achieve?
In your recommendation 2.2, You recommended that every homeschool student be assessed by the province. So as a follow-up to the first question, would this be a major change to the current legislation?
Well, the current legislation suggests that the minister has the right to test children if they so choose. So I think probably from a legislation point of view, that element may be there. I think what's a significant change is what's happening in practice, and that it's not happening now. And the department again has a number of options that they could do with this. I mean, they can. You know, they can look at children on a periodic basis to see how they don't have to do every child every time. They can look at it on a risk-based sort of process where those children that are doing well and they believe they're doing well, maybe they don't need to be tested on a. They can stagger those out a little bit more. So there's a lot of options that they can look at there.
Years ago, many of those who were being homeschooled were being homeschooled because of isolation, distance from school, a whole host of reasons. Now, today we have somewhere around 850 students that are being homeschooled. And I guess it has gone to perhaps a thousand, as you indicated. Many are being homeschooled for religious reasons, a whole host of areas involving curriculum, whether it's science, biology, sex education, evolutionary theory, all kinds of things are involved in the backgrounds today on the various reasons for homeschooling. And the question that comes to my mind is, will there still be some degree of freedom of choice on the parents' part?
Yeah, if I can say our primary conclusion with this audit was that the Department of Education can't wash its hands of its responsibility to safeguard the rights of the children involved, and that's the right to have a proper education by the time they grow up. But that does not mean that the department has to micromanage the system or to excessively reduce the desires of parents to manage their own children's education. They just have to do enough to see to it, to reassure themselves that no children are disadvantaged by this system, and that in the end, all children going through that program have the same rights to education as those in a public system.
So in homeschooling, there is a great recognition of the parents' responsibility. And as a follow-up to the previous question, will the implementation of your recommendations be seen as curtailing of the choices of parents, the choices that they now have?
It's a possibility that an initial reaction to these recommendations of ours could be seen that way if people just read quickly and don't consider what we're really saying. But I don't think that is not actually the case, and I think if the department does what we suggest, is that to engage in consultation with parents, to do so immediately, and involve them in the process, I don't think that there should be a negative reaction to what we're saying.
Moving on to the Trade and Convention Center, when I was the economic development critic a number of years ago, I always looked at the TCL as being an arm's length agency. And you actually used that quote, Mr. LaPointe, this morning. So you are, in fact, saying that it is an arm's-length agency, right?
Well, depending, it depends on what you mean by that term. But we mean by it is that it is supposed to operate with a high degree of autonomy and independence. But the all agencies in the province have a balance in the degree of autonomy they're allowed and the degree to which they're required to comply with provincial rules. And that's true with all of them, and it varies from agency to agency, but for the most part, that it's pretty standard, the degree to which that occurs.
Has the TCL already completed some of the recommendations, your recommendations as Auditor General?
Have they completed by now? I'm not sure I can say that.
Do we know?
Well, that's Mr. Terry, Mr. Spicer to talk to.
We wouldn't have done any audit work to assess whether they've the one that we know they've done is the CEO's expenses are at the time we were there were right after our meeting with them they began to the chair began to approve the CEO's expenses, but other than that particular one we haven't done any work to assess whether any of the comments that they've made as far as implementation are in fact accurate or have been done.
It's my understanding that some changes are being made, but it would be nice to know what the changes actually are. What has TCL done to ensure adequate accountability in future arrangements with HRM regarding Metro Center and Ticket Atlantic?
I can address that. What they're doing for future relationship with the city was not really part of our audit. We don't have a lot of information on that beyond knowing that they are engaged in negotiations with the city on the future relationship. But where that stands right now, we don't have a lot of information.
One of my concerns was why was there the recommendation to do another market analysis for the convention center when there have been something like 10 reports, assessments, and analyses already done?
Yes, the recommendation was to do an analysis to address the limitations in the economic impact information that were there, recognizing that a decision has been made already to proceed with a convention center, so that is not the issue. It was to provide future information for planning. However, I should point out that that recommendation was not, in fact, accepted by the government, so that will not proceed in any case.
When you made the recommendation for another market analysis, did you consider the other reports that were used by TCL in making decisions, those 10 other reports, assessments, and analysis?
We have reviewed and we've analyzed all the reports that were associated with this, and our findings, we're taking those into account.
Okay. Moving on to capital planning. Can you elaborate on the collaborative process used by the Infrastructure Repair and Renewal Committee to prioritize projects?
Yes, I'll ask Ms. Coleman-Saad, who did that audit, to deal with that question.
Thank you. I'm just going to make sure I'm speaking to the right committee. The committee names are very close and very easy to confuse. So the Infrastructure Repair and Renewal Committee is the committee that not only includes representatives at the department, but also a representative from each district health authority. And so the committee develops the funding criteria that are ultimately used to score the projects. When district health authorities submit their projects to the department, the districts are aware of what those criteria are going to be. And their representatives on that committee have an opportunity to assess all of the projects that have been submitted from the various districts and determine which ones will be put forward for ultimate approval, because the ultimate approval isn't at that level. It's they would make a recommendation for approval, essentially.
I'm wondering if you can speak to the improvements that you found in how the department approves projects. And what I'm asking is how things have changed from previous years, because I understand that there have been some fundamental changes from years gone by.
Certainly, several years ago, there would have been much more of a each district health authority submit your top three projects, and that would be what had gotten funded. Now they do have this pairwise system where they do use criteria to assess projects. So certainly, you know, some progress has been made in that regard. There are still, I think, areas where there's lots of opportunities to make additional progress. In certain of the committees or the groups, such as equipment, for example, the district health authorities have no idea what criteria the department uses to assess the projects that they submit. They're still asking for the same number of projects in certain areas from each district, which doesn't really take into account the size and mix of services in districts. Some districts may need more projects in a particular year than another district. So I think, you know, certainly there has been some progress made in terms of establishing some standard criteria in certain areas and in sharing that with the districts for some of the areas. And I think, you know, the next steps are to share those criteria in all areas and to start taking into account size and mix and other things that can result in much better decision making.
What about consistency of decisions made?
So we did identify some issues in terms of consistency of how some of the criteria were identified. We identified some issues with projects that seemed very similar in different districts but were scored differently, and some might have been approved and some not. We also identified some inconsistencies in how some of the criteria were applied. Instances, for example, in which a sample item that we tested scored high in terms of risk of harm, and the department staff indicated that it was because the district had said there had been some instances of harm or potential harm to staff and to patients from that piece of equipment, but in fact there was nothing in the district's submission related to that piece of equipment that supported that comment.
Did you find any instances where harm to patients or staff could be connected with failure to replace or repair equipment or infrastructure?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning part of that question.
Did you find any instances where harm to patients or staff could be connected with failure to replace or repair equipment or various forms of infrastructure?
No, we did not. In our specific testing, we didn't find any instances where, you know, there was a particular example of harm that occurred as a result of a piece of equipment not getting replaced.
Did you find any evidence of long-term capital planning within the district health authorities?
Certain of the authorities. Not all of the authorities have long-term capital planning, and the department itself doesn't have a whole lot of long-term capital planning. So Capital Health, for example, does have a three-year plan, but both Guysborough and South Shore did not have multi-year capital plans, and those are the three districts at which we did more detailed work, were Capital, Guysborough, and Ignish Street, and South Shore.
Could I check, Mr. Chair, how much time do I have left?
You still have 4 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Moving on to the Capital District Health Authority and the IWKIT audit. In the section on system security, the report is referring to access to authorized individuals. Is that correct? We're dealing with the CDHA IWKIT audit. Mm-hmm. And I guess at one point we're talking about a section on system security.
Yes.
And the report is referring to access to authorized individuals, and I'm just seeking if that is correct.
Yes, it is.
Okay. The report concludes that there are good physical security actions being taken at Capitol Health to ensure that access to the data center and the patient information is secure. Can you outline for us what some of the security actions are?
Yes, I'll ask Mr. Horgan to speak to that.
Fine. Yes. I might have to come back to that one because I'd have to find it in the report.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I do understand that there were some good practices that you discovered with the IWK, that the IWK has practices in place to protect the physical security of its systems, and that's on page 38 of the November report. And I'm wondering if you can elaborate on the good practices that you find at the IWK.
And Mr. Horgan.
Yes, we did note some good controls at the IWK in the area that you mentioned. We note that their data center is protected by having one place of entry and exit where visitors can be monitored as they come and go. Their data center is monitored 24 hours a day, which would be a best practice. Physical security measures are regularly tested to assess their effectiveness. There is environmental monitoring, which of things like temperature, humidity, which have to be closely controlled in a data center, and they have special sensors and softwares to make sure that these elements are kept under control. Any visitor to the data center has to be accompanied by an employee. So any visitor will be closely monitored. Anyone in the data center is required to wear visible identification badges. So if anyone spots someone walking around the data center without a badge, they can be approached and asked whether they should be there. There is training with respect to physical security at the data centers. We found there's an uninterrupted power supply in place, so those kind of systems are used in cases where maybe there's a power outage, usually a shorter one, and these are basically massive batteries that will kick in as soon as a power interruption occurs and keeps the computers running, perhaps until the power is restored or at least to allow for an orderly shutdown of computers without damaging them. And we found that there was regular maintenance and inspection being performed on equipment in the data center.
Excuse me, the time allotted to the NDP
for this
round has just expired. I think we'll follow the same order we did before, so we'll go back to the PC caucus. It's Mr. D'Entremont, is it? We'll go 15 minutes each time now.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm going to go back a little bit to the capital planning for the Department of Health and Wellness for a little bit. When you started your work, or even in the findings that you have here, have you an idea of what the infrastructure deficit is in the province right now when it comes to the health system? Were you able to sort of get a grab of that? Because from my history, I think I remember it being somewhere close to $1 billion, if not more.
What we do have and report on is an estimate by the department that $600 million would be required as a minimum over the next 10 years just to deal with the basic essentials of the areas we were looking at, as building infrastructure and equipment.
Did that include the replacement of the VG site or any of those much larger projects, or was that just more of the roofs and windows and minor equipments?
No, it does not include major building replacements like that. It deals strictly with maintaining the basic infrastructure and the equipment.
Okay. I was looking at the, I think Ms. Coleman said you were talking about the two oversight committees, and maybe you can give a better idea of exactly what those two planning committees do. Because I know from the feeding of the district health authority, sort of feed it up into the department, the department makes a determination from there. But can you give us an idea what those two different infrastructure committees do that sound, kind of sound the same?
Yes, ask Ms. Coleman Saad to answer the question.
Thank you.
They do indeed sound the same, and I'll refer to my report to make sure I don't confuse them because they're so alike. So there is one committee called the Infrastructure Repair and Renewal Committee, and that committee is looking at requests that are under $90,000. Then there is another committee called the Infrastructure Management Repair and Renewal Committee, and that committee looks at requests between 90,000 and 1 million, things over a million require an OIC. So the Repair and Renewal Committee has membership from each district health authority as well as staff from the department. The Infrastructure Management Repair and Renewal Committee doesn't have members from the districts on there, although the districts are aware of how that committee scores its projects. And then there's a third group, I guess you would call them equipment, and they look at the equipment needs, and that is comprised of staff from acute and tertiary care at the department. There's no district health authority representation, and what makes that one a little different is that district health authorities have no idea what criteria that group is using to score the projects that they submit.
Can you give us an idea of what kind of projects are submitted to each? I mean, you know, is it roofing? Is it windows? Is it, you know, those kind of, I mean, what kind of requests are being put through these committees?
Sure. So the Infrastructure Repair and Renewal Committee, which is the one that's under 90,000, would really be your smaller infrastructure type projects. So perhaps windows or, you know, if something of that sort. Your Infrastructure Management Repair and Renewal Committee would be starting to get into your bigger projects, but certainly nothing that would be a huge renovation or certainly no building replacements or anything, because it does have that cap of $1 million. So those would be things like, you know, your roof needs some work or those kinds of things that would cost perhaps in the hundreds of thousands, mm-hmm. but not in the millions or tens of millions or more. And then the equipment group deals with all equipment requests. So some of those could be much smaller. It could be, you know, a $50,000 item, whereas others could be a $3 million item. So it just depends. It is equipment, and it's whatever falls within that. So it could be, you know, one thing could be an MRI, one thing could be an X-ray machine, an ultrasound, all kinds of things.
In your findings, you were talking a lot about the utilization and trying to put some kind of handle on, you know, which machines are being used the most and therefore try to score them a little differently. How much of this, you know, from the research you've been doing, is it replacement because it's worn out or replacement because the technology has changed and the method of treatment and or testing is completely different, so they're asking for a completely different machine? And the example I have is sort of between a 32-slice CT versus a 64-slice CT. All of a sudden, the 32s were no good for anybody and they need a 64. How much of that did you see in there for requests?
I mean, I think it's a bit of both. You know, there is one area of the report where we talk about the age of equipment, and we use Capital Health as an example, and we talk about the age of the equipment. And if you take a look at that, you'll see it's, you know, it's the equipment in the province and the health system, some of it is getting pretty old. And so, you know, things do wear out and kind of require Band-Aids from time to time, perhaps to get, you know, if you don't have an approved project, to get you through to the next cycle when you might maybe get something approved to get that piece replaced, or sometimes things are needed to be replaced on an emergency basis. There is certainly also, you know, clinical practices change over time. Things are seen as, like, and your example of the 64-slice and 32-slice CT scanners is a good one. My understanding, is 64 slice CT scanners give them way better information and reduce the need for certain other more expensive tests like MRIs. So, for example, yes, there would be some of that as well, but I think a lot of the times what you'd be getting is there's a piece of equipment that's in probably getting towards the end of its useful life, past the end of its useful life, and what it's going to be replaced with is more in line with clinical practices today. Mm-hmm. So it's often the two together. It's not... I don't think there's enough money in the system for, you know, a five-year-old piece of equipment to be removed because clinical practices have changed. I think it's much more the older equipment that you're seeing getting replaced with newer stuff that is more in line with clinical practices.
Okay. Anna, you were talking about the lack of planning and having to adopt a sort of a longer-term planning process. Some are doing some three-year capital plans and others are... You know, there's been no evidence that they're doing any. So, what is a reasonable amount of planning? Is it a 3-year plan? Is it a 5-year plan? And how do we do that under the current way we budget in the province, which is a year by year budgeting process? It's a big question. I know. So.
It is, and certainly, I think long-term capital planning is challenging for a variety of reasons. There's the fact that because it is a province and government, it is a one-year, you know, horizon in terms of what's approved for your budget. And, you know, funds are not, there's not an excess of funds to put into the system. And so that's always a challenge as well. But I think, you know, particularly that second challenge of shortage of funds mean it's really important to do long-term planning. And whether it's a 3 or a 5-year window, I think is really up to the system and what the system decides works best for it. But that long-term planning is really key because then you have a sense of what's coming up and what are we going to need funding for in upcoming years. And, you know, hopefully if you start getting some utilization data and focusing on other areas where there's cost savings available and whatnot, then you can kind of take a long-term view and say, you know, if we do these things now, we'll save some funds. Perhaps that will give us a little additional funds next year. So even though you don't have an exact approved amount, you should still have a plan in place from a strategy perspective that would, you know, take things out over either a 3 or a 5-year window.
Does that ensure that future expenses don't become more expensive as time goes on? Because if you defer a piece of maintenance or defer a replacement, I mean, what's the future cost of that piece of equipment or that work going to be done? Will that kind of budgeting try to help that? I mean, I know it probably won't fix it, but, you know, and the example is, and I know probably the NDP will use this one, is the issue of a $100 million hospital that ends up being a $187 million hospital. Is, you know, does that help out in the end of having that longer-term view of things?
I mean, I think you're right. The longer-term view obviously won't fix everything and make sure that every bit of preventative maintenance that needs to be done gets done and that nothing gets deferred. But... you know, it does give you that opportunity to look at things and to maybe when you're taking that longer term view to say, well, this piece of infrastructure that really requires some repairs today is likely going to require a complete replacement if we don't do something with it in 3 years. And so maybe when you're looking at those 3 years, it sort of forces you to give much stronger thought to the preventative maintenance at an earlier point, because certainly you're right, when preventative maintenance does take place on a timely basis, it tends to cost the system less than deferring things and having to sometimes fix in an emergency or replace.
Seeing the sort of three committees that we have for this amount of work, is there a better process in to sort of amalgamate that into one, or is there a central office that could be used? Because by the look of it, it's sort of all over the department of how they do their capital planning. Is there, and I apologize, I don't remember if there's a recommendation in there of consolidating some of those things to make it more efficient.
There is no recommendation related to consolidating them. I mean, I think it's up to the department how they choose to carry out their approval and their review of the projects that the district health authorities submit. I think what's really important in that area is to get the districts involved, because you get the buy-in, obviously, from them at that stage, to make sure that they're aware of the criteria and of what the provincial priorities are. Because, for example, with the equipment area, districts have no idea how the Department of Health are going to score them. So a district could score something as its highest-ranked project. Mm-hmm. and it might not get funded because it doesn't rank high at all on in relation to other projects with how the department is scoring it. And I don't think that does anybody any good. I think, you know, if everybody knows what the provincial priorities are and how things are going to be scored, then districts can make a more realistic assessment of their projects as they're submitting them.
All right, changing a couple because I only got a few minutes left here, I think.
Yes.
Just going to the issue of homeschooling for just one quick second, is that we've heard a lot over the last number of years on the student information system at the Department of Education. Just wondering, how could that system maybe be used to track students when they're being homeschooled? Because, I mean, at some point, we've got to know who they are, and sometimes they, you know, they leave in grade 3 and they come back in grade 6 and things like that. Could that information system be used a little more appropriately, and who holds that data for that student information system? Does each district have that, or is that held centrally here in Halifax?
To answer that.
Thank you. Yes, and our report makes some recommendations on using that system better. Right now, each regional school board has access to its students' information, and of course, the Department of Education would have access to all the information. So we have made recommendations that it is a logical tool to use to track students moving either within school boards from homeschooling to a school board and vice versa. It's the information is there, and it certainly could be used in much more effectively to track students.
Okay. Because I was just wondering, because we hear a lot about that student system, and and you know, God forbid that I make a suggestion this way, because I'm married to a teacher, so if I actually suggested her that she do a little more work in tracking some students would be, I don't know, wouldn't be great at home. But there you go. I'm just trying to eat up some time here. Looking quickly at the IT systems, how do we balance the information flow of having a really good EMR or medical record system, and protecting the information of our public? Because, you know, there's a tremendous balance, I think, between these two issues. How do we make sure that the system, and I worry about the healthcare system, that if they get pushed upon, that they're going to back away and try to make things more, ultimately make things more secure, but then Nova Scotians won't have access to an EMR. So how do we balance those two competing priorities on the recommendations that you have here today?
I'd say we're not proposing, and wouldn't want to propose, that the department or the health authorities implement all kinds of controls that would slow down health delivery, would interfere with health delivery. Most of what we have in the chapter would simply make things more secure, add better processes, but not interfere with physicians in the hospital actually delivering. And that's not certainly anything we'd ever want to propose. I think it's quite feasible to improve the process. To make sure that medical records for patients are secure, with, you know, things like the access that we discussed before, and still keep it very efficient.
Thank you. The time in this round for the PC caucus has expired. We'll move back to the Liberal caucus. Mr. Goodin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to focus on the audit on homeschooling. I'm just looking for some clarifications. In your audit, you indicated you had there's approximately 850 students registered for homeschooling. Do we have a breakdown as far as, you know, what group of students are involved, or, you know, as far as elementary or junior high or senior high kids? Do we have those types of numbers?
I'll ask Mr. Spicer to deal with that. Thanks.
The department would likely have that information. I don't have it as the information with me here.
Do we know from those students if the majority are from rural areas or if they're from urban, or do we have a breakdown of those? If there's more
more students involved in homeschooling from the city than there are from rural Nova Scotia, for example? I'm just curious.
Again, the department would probably be the best to answer that, but from the files that we looked at, it was, they come from, there's, of course, based on the numbers in the HRM, there's a lot of homeschooled children in the HRM, but there are also, you know, a sort of proportionate number in the other school boards as well. So they seem to be rural, urban. There, as was mentioned here earlier, there's a number of, and a various number of reasons why kids homeschool, and some of them may be distance, but there's also reasons that for religious reasons they may be homeschooled. There may be, they may have issues within the school for bullying, as an example, or perhaps any other deficits that they may have that doesn't allow them to go to school on a regular basis. So there's a number of reasons as why. And they, and
okay, that leads me to my next question. Doesn't the department have any data as far as why students are registered with homeschooling? You know, you touch on bullying, and I was just curious as far as why are students in Nova Scotia registered to the homeschooling program? Did the department provide you with those reasons?
Just anecdotally, that you know, through our discussions, that there are, again, there are a number of reasons why kids may participate. Now, in each individual file, there would be a some information on that child, but the system that they have now doesn't, they, not that we've seen at least, generate sort of those types of statistics. They could probably go through and, okay, and figure it out if you ask them.
Mm-hmm. As far as homeschooling, is it available to every student in Nova Scotia, or is there guideline specifics that basically restricts, I guess, students from actually signing up for homeschooling? I'm just curious.
Every parent in the province has the right to homeschool their child if they wish.
Yeah. Okay. I think everybody, including the Department of Education, want to make sure that every student in Nova Scotia receives a proper education. I was kind of interesting reading, you know, in your little summary book here, the Department of Education is failing in its responsibility to protect the education rights of children enrolled to the provincial homeschooling program. I thought that was a very strong assessment. The department is failing. Which your audit would you recommend that homeschooling should continue or should be abolished? I'm just curious.
No, we're not making any judgments about the value of homeschooling as to whether it's good policy or bad policy. We don't go that route, and neither do we make any assessments as to whether individual students are in fact receiving good education or not. So our entire report is focused on the responsibility of the Department of Education to look after the children's rights, and that is the right to an education. So yes, it is a strong conclusion that they failed to do so, but I think if you talk to the department, they would in fact concur. They don't disagree with our report. This program, if it's is a policy decision of government to allow the right to homeschool. If they're going to do that, then they need to have a sufficiently robust program to do what has to be done, and that's what's lacking now.
I'm just curious, did the Department of Education agree with your findings that the department is failing students that are enrolled in homeschooling?
They agree with all our individual findings, and they didn't dispute our report.
Now, so I heard here this morning, Mr. Chair, in responding to an earlier question, You indicated that the department doesn't know if students who are enrolled in homeschooling are receiving a proper education. So I presume, again, that during the audit, the question was put to the Department of Education staff. I'm just wondering what kind of response did you receive when that question, you know, do you feel that students enrolled in the homeschooling program are receiving a proper education?
Well, the fact is that the department can't really answer the question. You can only go to the files on individual students, to the databases of information that are there, to the reports that are submitted by parents. And from all that information, you can't make any satisfactory conclusion about the state of education for these students overall or with any particular individual.
I'm looking at your recommendation 2.4. Mm-hmm. You know, how does the department know if homeschooling students are achieving appropriate learning objectives? You know, does the department do some testing? Do we, you know, how do we measure the outcomes for these students if they're achieving? When does the department decide it's time for a student to move up to the next level? So I guess what I'm trying to find out, if the department is failing, at the same time, how can the department justify if students enrolled in the homeschooling program, obviously, there's some kind of testing involved. So I'm just curious, with your audit, you know, what does the department do in order to more or less decide when the, you know, a student is actually meeting certain targets, certain objectives?
I would say they do not, in fact. They don't have targets or objectives for students. They don't have outcomes. They don't have reports from parents sufficient to be able to judge, and they don't do testing.
So again, I'm trying to understand what kind of guidance is given out to parents who are signing up their children for homeschooling. Isn't the department providing those parents with some clear guidance as far as what needs to be covered at home, what objectives needs to be met before students are moved to a different level?
I'd say no, they're not.
There's no guidance given to parents? Students just sign up or what?
They are pointed to... there is some guidance on the website. We don't feel it's adequate. And they are pointed as well to their private sector programs for homeschool children. But these are not assessed by the department either.
Now, we heard earlier that parents can actually ask for help from the department with homeschooling. I'm just curious what kind of help is available. You know, part of the process for a parent, do you go through the department? Do you go through the local school board? Do you go to the nearest school in the neighborhood or around home? I'm just curious, once a parent and a student signs up for homeschooling, are they practically on their own? Is anybody working with them? Is there anybody, you know, assuring that they're being assisted in any possible way?
Well, put it this way: there are two individuals at the department who run this program, and they are hard pressed to manage the paperwork involved in registering. Registrations and receiving reports and putting them in the files. As to actual assistance to parents in teaching their children, I'm not sure if there's anything available, certainly not from the department.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I recall back in my earlier days when I was teaching over 20 years ago, we had... not that many students at our school that had
were following homeschooling. So I presume homeschooling has been going on for years in our province. I fail to understand, you know, the department is actually failing our students who are actually enrolled in homeschooling program. You know, especially with this the system being in place for so many years, I'm sure that the department has been hearing from schools, especially where we have students that are enrolled in the at home and then decide at some point to return back to school or go back to home. So I'm sure the department has been receiving a lot of feedback, I'm sure, throughout our province as far as what's working, what's not working, where the folks should be placed, if additional resources should be provided. I'm just curious from your audit, did the department feel that they're actually offering homeschooling to our students? Or does the department feel comfortable with basically with the system that's in place? Naturally, they didn't dispute the fact that you recommended that the department is failing our students enrolled in the program. So I'm just wondering, as far as the department themselves, do they feel that this entire system needs to be overhauled? So I'm just curious.
I can say that I don't know how the people in the department felt in the, you know, before we went in prior years about this program. I know it has been this way for some time, but our discussions with the department on this indicate that the department does view this as a serious matter, and is not. And whether they were comfortable with it before or not, they're not comfortable with it now. And are certainly, by the indications they've given to us, are committed to improving it.
What's your audit? Did you get a chance to go outside the Department of Education to receive some feedback or evaluations from school boards or from schools? Somebody outside the department? Did your audit actually go, you know, did you get a chance to drill further into the homeschooling program?
Mm-hmm. We focused on the department, but I think I can ask Mrs. Spicer to talk to that a little bit.
As part of the audit procedures, we did go out and talk to the some of the directors at the regional school boards, trying to understand what is the school board's role in homeschooling, what happens when a child leaves the public school system and goes into homeschooling or comes back, and that's where we learn that when a child comes back from a homeschooling program to the public school system, they are tested at that time at the public school system to see where they stand, what areas they may be weak, and where they may need some additional resources. We also learned about what communications may be happening from the school board back to the department with respect to homeschooling. So we talked to four regional school boards during the audit.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear that, you know, you've certainly gone outside the department. Did the audit get a chance to talk to some of the students, you know, especially the senior high kids that are involved in the homeschooling program, to try to get some feedback from them? You know, are they comfortable? Are they pleased with the program? Would they recommend changes to the program? I'm just curious, were students involved with the audit?
We'll hear the answer, and then that'll be the end of this round.
No, we didn't talk to specific students as part of the audit. We basically went to the school boards and the management at the school boards just to see what involvement they have with the program.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We've now finished two rounds for all the caucuses. I understand the NDP is going to waive its opportunity in this round, so perhaps we can move on to the business of the committee in just a moment. We'll finish a little early. I would, however, before we do that, invite the Auditor General to make any summary comments he might want to offer to us.
Well, certainly, thank you, Mr. Chair, but in closing, I'll just simply say that I and my staff have appreciated the opportunity to discuss our report with you today, and you know, this committee's work is an important part, an important component of government's accountability framework, and we're pleased to have an opportunity to contribute to it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much to your staff for being here today and for your prompt and fulsome answers to the questions. We will turn now to the business of the committee. We have a few items. The first is listed as approval of the record of decisions. What that means is the report from the subcommittee on agenda and procedures with respect to topics coming forward in the future. Unless there are any changes, I would entertain a motion to accept it. Mr. Wynot.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I move the adoption of the record of decision from the subcommittee on agenda procedures going from January the 9th, starting on January the 9th, going to looks like many, many weeks into 2013.
Yes, and just I should note that several of the topics have not actually been scheduled yet, and as usual, scheduling will depend on the availability of witnesses, and we, as usual, will leave that in the hands of the clerk to schedule. So there's a motion. Is a seconder? Mr. Younger, thank you very much. Any discussion about this? If not, thank you very much. I take it all in favor. Is that right? Okay. We accept that list. Thank you, and invite the clerk to work on further detailed scheduling. That's the first thing. Second is just to note that we have received a letter addressed to the committee from the Department of Health and Wellness about infection prevention and control. The letter is dated December 6th. I think all members should have this letter from the Deputy Minister in front of them, and unless there's anything that arises from that, I take it that this will be for information of the members of the committee. And the next item is a slight change in scheduling. Our meeting for December 19th is going to have to be postponed and rescheduled to February the 6th, 2013. Could the clerk just remind me of why that is?
Well, actually, there's going to be a caucus that's not going to be available on that day, so we won't have any representation.
Right. So some people are not available for the meeting that day. Thank you. our next meeting date, then, will be on Wednesday, January 9th, 2013. We will start that day with an in-camera briefing by the Auditor General and his staff at 8:30, and continue then with witnesses from the Department of Health and Wellness in our usual time, and the topic will be long-term care. Before we break, I just wanted to note something that I think might be implied in the in-camera briefings. These, I think, are always not decision-making meetings. They're essentially briefings. The reason I flag this is just to make it clear that I expect that not all members of the full committee may attend the briefing, and therefore I just want to make it clear that there wouldn't be any formal decisions made during a briefing session. So unless there are questions about that, we'll perhaps move on. Are we ready for adjournment? Is there any other business before the committee, Mr. Younger? No? A motion to adjourn from Mr. Younger. Thank you. And we stand adjourned. Thank you for your help.